Jesus said his kingdom is not of this world. And yet he chose to be part of this world and to live among us. We see a vision of kingship first in Daniel. The ancient one, it says, sits atop a throne of fiery flames and with wheels burning with fire. The throne would shoot fire that would flow out from the ancient one's presence. And the ancient one wore white and had hair the texture of wool. To get the power from this ancient one that gives dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. Yeah, well, surely that kingdom, not of this world. The initial audience who would have been reading Daniel was Jews living under the rule of the Syrian emperor Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, so nicknamed because he thought he was a manifestation of the gods. He outlawed the practice of Judaism and forbade the population from following the Torah. Now, whether the ruler is Pharaoh or Babylon or Syria or Emperor Epiphanes or Caesar, whether the ruler is Hitler or Stalin or the slave master, people living under oppressive rule have found hope when they realize God's rule is more powerful than what a greedy or dangerous ruler on earth may offer. And even if God's just, fair rule is not the recognized law of the land, the idea that God can rule in our hearts, in our minds, in our actions, these are places where even the most powerful rulers cannot touch. This gives us a sense of freedom and hope for something better. Jesus' kingdom was not of this world. Søren Kierkegaard shared this parable as a way of understanding Jesus' kingdom. Once there was a prince who was on the verge of inheriting his father's kingdom and becoming a king. After many years of training and of study and of apprenticing, his father and the wise elders of the kingdom deemed him ready for the role of king. His only hesitation was that he was single and he wanted to reign with a partner by his side. He didn't want to do it by himself, and he longed to marry. So far, all the eligible women that he had met at court just did not stir his heart or his soul. And he wanted to marry for love and friendship. One day, he was riding through the marketplace when he was struck by the sight of a woman who sold beautiful and sturdy pottery at one of the stalls. It was her eyes that captivated him at first. They were kind and sparkled with fun. They were thoughtful as well. In fact, he found that looking into them was like looking into the depths of a clear, deep well. There were shadows and sunlight there. He began to observe how she treated her customers with respect and fairness, yet always struck a good bargain for her family. He saw the steadiness and fine, detailed creativity of her work during times when customers were scarce, throwing pots at her potter's wheel and painting those ready for the kiln. Sure enough, he fell in love. "How shall I approach her? Get to know her, let her get to know me," thought the prince. As prince, he could simply order her to marry him, but he wanted to marry for love. He could arrive at the door of her humble home in his regal uniform on a fine horse, bearing gifts, and sweep her off her feet. But he wanted to marry for friendship and shared values, not because he was a prince who could afford a life of rich luxury. Perhaps he could disguise himself as a daily laborer and get to know her at the marketplace. Then, when they were in love and ready to marry, he could reveal his true identity. But he did not want to marry out of manipulation. After much contemplation and with his growing interest for the young woman as a guide, the prince finally made a decision. He would renounce his claim to the throne. He would move into the neighborhood in which he lived and begin work as a carpenter, for he had been trained in architecture and in the fine art of carving in his studies. He loved the feel of wood in his hands. He would get to know all the people in her community, go to worship with them, make music at parties with them, help build their houses, shop with them in the marketplace. In this way, he hoped he would become the young woman's friend and someday confess his love for her. And that is what he did. That was Soren Kierkegaard's parable to explain how Jesus left the throne of kingship and came to live among us, to be part of us, and to know our experience. And it speaks to the mystery surrounding Jesus' identity, which others such as Pontius Pilate were constantly trying to unveil. "Are you the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked him. "Your own nation and the chief priests have handed you over to me. What have you done?" The messianic secret, or the effort for Jesus to hide who he really was, may have worked to protect Jesus for some time. Sort of like that uncle at Thanksgiving who your parents always told you showed up with his best friend. But when you were old enough to really look at them and see them, you could tell they were partners who deeply loved each other. People who were really listening to Jesus, whether they were his followers or those who found his teachings threatening, could see that the kingdom of which he spoke was not the expected kingdom of empire. When our kingdom is not limited to the laws and norms of this world, when we are not shackled by the people and things that try to rule our minds, our hearts, and actions, we have the ability to dream and imagine the world as God would have it. "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." When I was in Atlanta, Georgia with my family over Thanksgiving, we took a day off from feasting and climbed Stone Mountain just outside of Atlanta. If you've never been there, Stone Mountain is an enormous quartz granite rock. I am in awe of the natural wonder that is Stone Mountain, and I love to hike it and see the view from top as I've done since I was a child. My family went there often when I was growing up, but it wasn't until I reached adulthood that I became aware of its troubling history. For years, it was inhabited by Creek and Cherokee Indians, but in the mid-1900s, it was used as a quarry. The quarry owner was an active member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he allowed the Klan to gather on top of the mountain. Although they stood beside a flaming cross, what this group really worshipped was not Jesus. It worshipped white supremacy. Some close associates of the Klan raised money to carve a memorial, a huge memorial, to the face of this beautiful, magnificent mountain of the generals of the Confederate Army. Now, although the residents of the city of Stone Mountain are, at this point, 73% Black or African American, they have looming above them, seen for miles, the faces of the people who fought to keep them enslaved. But there was someone who was very good at explaining the limits of human power and kingship. And he was good at explaining to this country what it would look like for us to consider instead to look at God's holy reign of love and let that rule us. His name also was King, and he was from Georgia. the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made this speech. And over the past weekend, I was thinking about it a lot as I climbed Stone Mountain, as I looked at the carving on its face. And it occurred to me how much the imagery of Stone Mountain figured into his 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom speech. Here's what he said. "I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, and I'll add women, are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And before the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is our faith. My faith that I go back to the mount with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the genuine discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This is what it looks like when God is our ruler. May we live to see that kingdom come. Amen.